this. I'm Nick, I'm an addict.
Hi, Nick.
I just get that in. It doesn't matter how long I've been around. Doesn't that build up where you're about to steam into someone or you're about to just on that thing and that fear? And it seems to me the unconscious can't discriminate between the fact that there was two of us speaking and all that, because I've had that since we started. It was when I first sat down here. I could feel that bang, bang, bang starting and that coming up to speaking. And I've learned to just accept it. It's about being human. It's about being sober, but it's about being without anything in my system. So the intoxication comes from that other source of just the power of being here. And it doesn't matter how much I've come, you know, my thing is to be spontaneous. If I come with any kind of plan, it's doomed, you know, or any kind of attempt to do a sequential run through my addiction and how it happened and how I got here. And I will do that, so, you know, I'll do all that stuff. I remember what it reminds me of, and it was like my whole thing was replayed for me listening to Jessica and just sitting here and being in this situation, is there's no way I can come into this kind of situation and not show up, you know. I can't sit here and be fraudulent. And that's great, because I've spent my life wearing masks, as we all do. I'm funny, I can do all that stuff. I did it when I was using, I've done it in recovery. And there's something about this that forces me, whatever my, and I remember my first sponsor said to me, when you're doing a chair, you've got to be prepared. You've got a handover, you know, step three job, and you've got to be prepared to sit there and make a fool of yourself or say nothing. And that's okay. You know, if you get up here and you're choked and I'm inarticulate or unable to speak or whatever, and that's okay, you know. Oh, that's better. I've been clean for 17 years. And I went through treatment, and I went to meetings first, then I went to treatment. And what happened was, I was 37 when I came in, I'd been using for a long time. And I, rather than go off into the big rigmarole, because I'm going to talk about that as well, because this is Narcotics Anonymous, you know, I'll talk about the drugs I used and all that, because that's what I wanted to hear when I first came in. I didn't want to hear some thesis or dissertation on whatever. I wanted to hear that people had done the same as me. I needed that identification. Less so as time's gone on. The first thing I remember, I'll just give you an example of the kind of using. I ended up living outside Liverpool when I was a kid. A lot of alcoholism in the family. My father was like a dry drunk, really. So he was unpredictable. And if he had a drink, he didn't drink that much. But when he did drink, he'd alternate between sort of violence and sentimentality very quickly. So you didn't know where you were with him. And so, you know, I became always on tenterhooks, that dreadful anxiety. The kind of thing I felt when I was sitting down here at first was that fear of not, always fear of being hit, fear of being shouted at, fear of something so innately wrong with me that I wasn't quite the ticket in any situation. And, you know, to this day I carry those suspicions of self that I'm less than or I'm inadequate or I'm not quite the ticket, I don't belong, all that stuff. I remember when I first came to went to a meeting at the Red Cross, and it wasn't the first time I went to a meeting, but the first kind of big meeting I went to. I was in treatment at the time on the King's Road in the old Red Cross place. And it was a closed meeting, so it was only for addicts. And I had this terrible fear I was going to be kind of exposed because I hadn't really used enough and all that. Now, I'd had a methadone for like 15 years. I'd used intravenously since 1970. I'd used my groin for the last 10 years of using. I'd used enough, do you know what I mean? But the power of that kind of, wherever I was, I could find a way of thinking, oh, I probably don't quite fit, you know, I'm an outsider. I'm just coming back to that place when I was about 14 or 15. I remember the kind of time when I was about six or pre the age of six, where I remember it kind of feeling, you know, the world was sunny and everything was good and that. But for whatever happened or whatever the reasons were, after that, as that fear cut in, and always feeling like an outsider, always feeling different. It wasn't, you know, I used lots of drugs for a long time. I injected intravenously, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. The fucking relief. The first time I remember is being outside the Twisted Wheel in Manchester. Northern Soul place, before even the word Northern Soul, it was just a soul place. I'd gone there, I was frightened, another guy persuaded me to go to this all-nighter. I think I was 16 or 17. We got there, he bought 20 blueies outside, 20 purple hearts. And I remember the kind of, the excitement and the buzz outside the outside the railway station there. People were selling kind of this on Black Atlantic and that on Chess and all these singles and all that. There was all this kind of real thing. But I was also just that fear there. And everyone else seemed like men. They seemed like grown-ups. I was always like a shuffling, callow youth, you know, a bit weedy and all that. And the guy gave me 10 blueies. This tough guy with me called Paul Tye, who was kind of a wild, you know, armed robber, thug kind of guy, but half sort of, you know, went out poaching and stuff like that as well, lived by me. And he was like, take them, la, you know, and gave me these 10 blueies. And even then, I kind of thought 10 sounded like a lot, you know. So I took 6, and I gave him 4 back, and he went, oh, fuck's sake. So he took 14, I took 6, headed up to this club. And all my kind of adolescent crippledom, the wrong clothes, you know, with the wrong, you know, sort of, my hipsters weren't quite right, all that kind of stuff, all the sort of feeling of being this sort of twisted elephant man kind of character. I got to the club. By the time I got to the club, I was shitting myself. I remember the fear, because I didn't know anything about what I'd taken. I didn't know whether it was like LSD, what was going to happen or anything. And I got near the club, and I could feel my heart pounding, and they were like, the bouncers were there, you know, at the bottom of the stairs. And as I say, I was this kind of weedy, sort of like shuffling, kind of street urchin character. By the time I got those down those stairs, that took, say, 10, 15 minutes, I was all right. You know? Suddenly, I was in my skin for the first time in my life. I felt complete, you know, I could look the bouncers in the eye, I felt okay. I could talk to women, which I'd never been able to do before. I could talk to guys. I was in the club, I was dancing, you know, I was kind of... And I actually felt like I'd arrived. You know, there was that real sense of that terrible anxiety being dispelled. Later on, I remember actually sitting when we started, we'd buy like I used to buy things like an ounce of dope for 10 quid. I'd cut it into 12 £1 deals and I'd sell them. So that was like the kind of level of business we were doing. But it felt really like something, you know, after the kind of the bleak, you know, root crop nastiness of Lancashire and fucking, you know, bleak fields and, you know, and by that time we had long hair, so we'd go for the bus and you get chased by skinheads and stuff like that, you know. It was like, and a lot of the time I was always in fear. You know, we used to go before that, because in the sort of skinhead mod days that preceded that, I'd be dancing and, you know, there'd be some kind of soul thing on at this place, and then someone would come over and go, come out, Nicky, there's lumber, there's a fight or something. I'd have to join on, terrified of this big crew of others, and we'd be fighting some like miners from Wigan or something. There'd be guys with big quiffs about, well, men, you know, tattooed men. And I was like this, I was one of those guys, those being in a fight or anything like that, I'd be one of those guys, come out, fuck, you know. So it was all that fear. So I'm at a guy's house. We've got this, whatever it was, 4 ounces of dope. We're splitting it up. We feel like we've arrived. It's like Scarface or something. And this guy there said, listen, mate, I had some money over and I got this box of morphine sulfate amps, right? Half grain amps of morphine sulfate. And I remember the kind of thrill of seeing them. Now, I had no illusions about this stuff. I wasn't stupid. You know, I knew opiates were addictive. I wanted nothing to do with them. I had hippie-esque leanings. It was all a spiritual quest and all this. And in the end, this guy said, do you want one of these amps? And I said, okay, you do 5 bob or something mad like that. I had this half-grain amp of morphine sulfate. And I remember the fear, because this guy hit me up with it. I'm sitting on the edge of the sofa and all the rest of it, and this terrible fear. Then I was kind of, you know, physically sick, and I was sort of vomiting and all that. But in between the sort of, because every time I moved, I'd go, I'm all right now. But even the movements were going, I'm all right now. I'd go, and I'd be sort of green, you know, and I'd go, it's gone now. And that went on for like what seemed all night. But within the gap, this shows you the quality of life, doesn't it? Someone said, what's it like? And I said, well, when I'm not being sick, it's fucking really good. It's really good. It's better than before. But that was the one for me. That was the one that kind of silenced and exercised that opiate thing, when all that kind of octopoid mass of feelings and feeling exposed and vulnerable and all that blushing and shuffling and really, you know, fear, no control of voice or body or anything else. Feeling, if someone asked, if I remember someone asking me directions somewhere, and I said, you go down there, and you go, oh, and you're poking her, and like my fingers are going, and you talk to her. I was that kind of, you know, dyspraxic, so that my shoes were like big, long Disney sort of curved things. If I danced with someone, I'd start treading on them, and I was like this, oh, that really kind of self-obsessed, and the opiates removed all that, you know. I ended up breaking into chemists. It was the thing. I remember a guy, a mate of mine, saying, wouldn't it be great if we'd been orphans? It'd be fucking great then. We'd have no guilt or shame. You know? We'd do what we liked and really be here. You know, this parent stuff gets in the way. And that, but that was like the kind of, that did that for us. You know, that was the thing that allowed me to suddenly be there in Liverpool. You know, the pub in Liverpool, the O'Connor's Tavern, used to get, and it used to be like, it was right by Liverpool Lane, so you get all kinds of guys from all different sort of mixed race guys and all this on the thing, and it was formidable. You know, it was an intimidating place, and people would be selling, you know, 10 bob deals of dope outside and all that sort of thing. You know, and they all used to stand outside. I was like this shuffling, oh really, you know, blushing and, you know, spilling things and all that. And these guys would be like, oh, my mother died last night, really, fucking fascinating. I mean, there'd be no, they were untroubled by affect or emotion of any sort whatsoever. And I so craved that switched off robotic, you know, oblivion. Not the oblivion of Barbs or Valium or stuff like that. It was that other thing that I got with opiates. That was the one for me, right? End up with a script. I was breaking into chemists, and you know, in those days it wasn't like you got a regular supply of anything. So basically, I'd have gear for 3 weeks, then I'd be withdrawing, then I got this methadone script and had that for a while. And the thing is, without going more into the details of the drugs, I ended up using Dicanol, were a big thing with us. We broke into chemists, and to this day, we used to get this thing. You'd do about 3 Dicanol, and it'd be in my groin. And when you got a good hit with them, where it just, there'd be a pause where the universe would stand still, man. After you, when you think, that's it, that's in, it's blood, the blood's black. You know, we had this thing, because, you know, the people of this art, in Liverpool, people lost fingers left, right and centre through it in arteries, you know. And to be reduced, we'd been reduced to the level where someone said, Billy Brown got taken to hospital with he hit an artery in his finger. And I said, how is he? He said, oh, he's fine, but he's got Love and Hut written on his fingers now. And everyone went, ah! You know, it was considered like, it was, we somehow got so brutalised and so, but what was it? I actually remember walking down Lark Lane in Liverpool with another guy, and some sort of, this guy was like, he was some sort of street chemist who knew all the things. He was the first, he was sort of looked on as some sort of explorer in Liverpool. He was the first one to map out groin shots, you know, and explain what size needle he had to do, you know. He was sort of, you know, it was like on a level of sort of North Sea oil drilling, this guy would be. I mean, walking along the street, and someone came to consult him, right? Some kind of shuffling sort of guy with kung fu slippers on, and said, Billy, how do you know when it's in an artery, and how do you know when it's in the vein? He said, well, the arterial blood's oxygenated, so it's bright red. And the guy said, I fucking can't remember all that. So he said, all right, I'll put it simply for you. He said, if it's black, give it a whack. If it's red, danger ahead. He said it about 4 times on the spot. It was like some old scene of minstrelry, you know, or some kind of like Homeric thing where someone learns something. And the guy went off going, you could see him with this mantra going on. He saw the guy about 3 days later, like, you know, like King George, like with some, the mad dude with some kind of gouty leg like this, glowing, you know, sort of frying eggs on this fucking huge leg that burst out of his trousers. And he went, I want a word with you, love. And Paul said, he said, you fucking stitch me up. He said, no, no. He said, I told you. He said, if it's black, give it a whack. If it's red, danger ahead. And this guy went, oh, sorry, lad. He said, I thought you said, if it's red, off your head. When we came down to London, the reason I say that stuff like that, because it is funny, that's simple, you know. We can all say, yeah, but it's tragic and the underlying themes and all the rest of it. But the reality is, to this day, I'll say this, when I see people staggering around a debris or a bomb site or whatever, drinking special brew and all that, there's a part of me and people go, that guy must be in real pain, man, he needs help. It's bollocks, you know. That was never painful for me. This is painful. All that spectacular stuff, that's why I did it. Do you know what I mean? And all those years, you know what was painful for me? When I came into recovery, I was a snob around what drugs I'd used, because I was a heroin addict for years and years. And I used cocaine and heroin, and that's what I did, you know, and they were my drugs of choice. The reality is, it wasn't true. My drugs of choice for the last number of years of my using were codeine linters, the occasional methadone script, you know, occasionally gear, which I didn't like anymore, because I used to withdraw so quickly. You know, without any kind of getting, I'd get pinned but wouldn't feel any effect kind of thing. So it was sort of, it was done for me, it was played out. And basically at the end it was booze, codeine linters, speed, because I'd reinvented some sinister adolescence, some Peter Pan thing where I'd take whacking quantities of like North London, cat's piss, fucking stinky, you know, that stuff. You go, fuck, you know. Well, you don't think I'll get a wash, you think, I better get some methadone. Someone said to me once, you know what, I said to this guy, you know when you've been withdrawing for days and you fucking stink and it's like some chemical sort of radiating, you know, there's cats, tomcats approaching you like that one. And Then you have a hit and it's okay and you don't smell anymore. Do you really not smell anymore? Or is it just an illusion, this guy? Oh, no, no, it's well known. You don't smell anymore. I had an occasion in Liverpool. This is the last bit of walking down Prince's Avenue in Liverpool. This is on a bank holiday. So I've had no methadone for days. I'm going down to take my methadone off, which is like, it's not a billion mils or something. It's like 30 or 60 mils or something. 3 days, it's been 90 mils of methadone. Heading down to the chemist. I've got no money for bus fare, anything else. I'm walking along Prince's Avenue, which is this big kind of boulevard through all this kind of faded grandeur, ship owners' houses and all that. The only goal in life is to get to that chemist, right? That's the most important thing. I've got 2 miles to go. It's fucking, the sun's beating down, it's hot, I'm sick, I'm withdrawing, I'm down to the bone, you know, I'm just this kind of wraith, you know, heading down through with this purpose. And some guy appears in front of me and says, "All right, Nicky, do you want any speed?" Now, as anyone who's had any kind of experience of using, if you're withdrawing, it's a really good idea to take amphetamine. That will really help. That'll sort it out. And in the first moments of relative sanity, I went, "Oh no, no, get DB Hartam." And then I went, "Oh, hang on, can you lay it on me?" And he said, "I can lay it on you, lads, till Friday." And I went, "Okay, I'll have it." You know, so next thing I've got this gram of speed and the chemist and the methadone down there, So next thing, I'm in this kind of house, pulling the corrugated iron off this sort of deserted house. I'm in there, got my works out, got this boiler suit on that I used to wear. I used to like it like a Pete Townsend kind of boiler suit, so I'd be kind of naked except for this boiler suit with a horrible pair of little skivvies on from then, some Brian Nylon tie-dyed, you know, type that irradiate your bollocks so you just... I drop this overall down, I get my works out of the sort of... screwdriver pocket, you know, from down there, get the bits of tobacco out of it and all that. Put the gram of speed in the thing, look around, there's no water in the place. I'm kind of searching for water. The place, the water's been cut off, there's not even in the system. So eventually I thought, I know, you know, like real Blue Peter, mother of invention stuff. I thought, if I get a good hit in my groin and pull the blood back, it'll come in and then I'll just keep doing it. And I almost wanted to tell someone because it felt like such a breakthrough, you know, in medical science. So I did it, and I did this real juddering hit. You know, one of those ones where it's grinding on the sides, and it's like that. It was all in, pulled the works out, put it down. There was that awful moment when I thought, I wonder whether that was a wise thing to do. And at the moment, like, you know, I'm withdrawing, and then slowly with this sort of gathering somewhere deep, outside my body somewhere, in some hinterland, some parallel universe, I could feel the gathering of the amphetamines. It started to march up, and this hot flush came up my body. And suddenly I was there, in this place with this boiler suit around my ankles with the most powerful desire to defecate I've ever had, accelerated by this amphetamine. So I kind of crouched down in the corner. By then, all I could remember was that I'm in some previous halcyon golden age when everything was better, like 20 seconds before, when I was just withdrawn. It was fucking great in those days, wasn't it? 50 yards and 20 seconds ago, I did. So I kind of explode on the floor of this place. Look around for paper. I'm using like a ration book or an old Park Drive pack to wipe my arse. The curtains, which are covered in kind of bird droppings, you know. So there's like, it's like it's gone into some Beckett universe. It's just, by then, I'm just having to grit my teeth and just keep dead still and just go, and be focused and totally on mission. So I do all this. I put my arms in the boiler suit. I flick it up. I feel the slap on my neck. Right? Now, when I finally emerged from that house, I had a choice. I could either go back home, which was 200 yards away, and get cleaned up, or I could go a mile and a half that way and get my methadone. The answer's easy. So I'm standing in the centre of Liverpool. I remember it was the first time I went to the chemist. And as I came in, normally, you kept yanging around, you felt less than and all that. Not on that day. It was like, he was out. He was out with my methadone like that. You know, holding it out with some biblical stance. I was there walking through the shop, people falling away from me, you know. And here's the best thing. I got outside the shop, I drank about 70, 80 mils of this methadone, a big quafferoonie, a big Falstaffian sort of old English medieval plasteroonie of this green, you know, this. And it was that, I was that dry as a bone, I was that kind of leached of all chemicals, that it just sort of, it was like my body went, and just sucked it in like a sponge. And all that kind of, all this sort of crowding, Dantean sort of accompaniment of fucking demons and howling and dead relatives and things slithering down my feet, they all just vanished back in somewhere, and suddenly I was there outside going,
greetings. I am whole once more, you know, I am healed. They should build a monument here. That was the other time was waking up in bed after withdrawing for days with the same pair of underpants I'd had on for weeks. And really sick and getting up like Lazarus and taking these underpants down and seeing a gram packet. At first, just a packet. I won't go into that one. I've done enough. But that was the upside of it, right? That was the kind of... But what happened to me? Came to London. What I was saying, I always do this kind of all over the place stuff. But what I'm saying is, none of that was difficult. What was difficult, what I remembered as recovery's gone on, is how painful it was for me before I discovered those drugs, you know? And the kind of sense of alienation I felt then, the sense that my clothes didn't fit, the fear, the feeling ugly, physically ugly, inarticulate, stupid. You know, I left school feeling stupid. Always felt guilty for something I didn't know what it was. All that essential suspicion of self, but somehow I was just wrong, and that was impossible. I was beyond healing. So it's taken me years to sort of get this thing around. As I say, I still carry those suspicions of myself. And what this program's given me, this has been a long time coming, right? And this is sort of working the steps in a desultory way and then getting to a rock bottom and then, you know, really getting in there. And I've got better at it as time's gone on. And I've realised, for me anyway, it is about showing up and it's about realising. What a guy said to me, he said, you're okay. Your behaviour may not be, but you're okay. At the centre, you're innocent, you're a child of the universe, and this is about love. Do you know what I mean? And what I was taught, kind of outside this fellowship as well as in, but with later, you know, recovery type stuff, was that usually, at core, we tend to have let's just say I, rather than generalise or push stuff onto anyone else. What I discovered was that, at core, when I've dropped down and got through all the masks and all the bullshit and all the performing and everything, is that I feel unlovable. And I also feel incapable of giving love. That's my ego's suspicion of self, right? And somewhere in that, whatever the fucking process was that ended up in addiction and whatever, you know, is that somewhere my authentic self abdicated and the ego took over. So it's always been like a war. It's always been about masks. So no wonder I breathed a sigh of relief when I had that morphine. You know, no wonder it was like, that has been so good. It's like, suddenly I don't have to explain anymore. I mean, I like doing the funny stuff and all that, and I think it's all right, you know, I'm absolutely okay with it. But the depth of the stuff I've got from recovery is beyond articulation. And it's not about me explaining it or conveying it in that way, because it doesn't travel in that sense. It's a feeling, and it's about feeling okay. And what I was given in recovery, first by a counsellor, was that I was all right, and somehow I actually heard him. Because that was what it was, because I could never hear, you know, I wasn't willing, open-minded and honest, you know. I'd always had, and then another counsellor in treatment said to me, he said, you've done really well, blah, blah, blah. I said, yes, but, and in the end he stopped me. He said, you know, he said, it's a real arrogance when you say but, and don't actually stop and listen to what's being said to you, you know. And he said, it really hurts, because it feels like, you know, we try to give you affirmation, and you don't just dismiss yourself, but you dismiss us as well. And that was like, I'm not saying I easily got that. I mean, that's taken years to start to get, is that ability to think, fucking hell, I'm all right, you know. And realise that with everybody I sit in these rooms, I'm judgmental, I do all the stuff, and oh, for fuck's sake, not him, and all that. And what I've learned over the years, it always comes back to me. You know, it's always about me. And that's the good part, that's the liberating part. Like Jessica, I have no idea where this comes from. You know, there's lots of alcoholism in the family and all that, but I'm really not interested in finding out the genesis of my illness, because I think it was Artie Lang said, a lot of people, you can open a cell door for them, but they won't leave the cell till they found out how they got in there in the first place. But the door's open, you know. And there's a sense of this. And, my first sponsor was AA guy, came up to me. He said, have you got a sponsor? It was like that, it was kind of Joy's thing. You know, have you got a sponsor? And I said, no. And I was still in that Uriah Heep, you know, I just come round, dead deferential, really like, yes, certainly, I'll do that, you fucking bastard. You know, that kind of, I wasn't able to be saved. And he said, I'm your sponsor, you ring me each day, twice. I went, certainly, thank you, I'm very grateful, you know. I'm not ringing him, you know. and then was in the house in groups, you know, in treatment going, if he rings me, I'll say this, then he'll say that, and then, you know. And it was all that world of speculation and nonsense. I bumped into the guy in a meeting, and he suddenly appeared next to me and he said, you haven't been ringing me. And I said, no, because I don't think it's working. He said, no, the wire. He said, I think you need someone more appropriate to you, you know, whatever your history is. And suddenly he was human. I was no longer demon, because it was nothing to do with the guy. It was me unable to say what I wanted. Do you know what I mean? And just going along, because I was fighting to do otherwise. Scared of being shouted at, scared of, you know, whatever it was. And years later, so he was my first guy, and that guy gave me, you know, we were together for what, 60 days or something, but he gave me the list, pray for the bastard, you know, all that kind of stuff, write your resentments down, help a newcomer, you know, do something and don't tell anyone about it. I found that extremely difficult, actually. I might have done it through a paper that I've had to say, you know, that day, you know, 11 years ago, and that guy was asking for bus fare outside of me, I gave it to him. I gave him some of it anyway, or something like that. But the thing I learned about this, because you know when you first come around and people say, what you need to do this, you'll die. If you wear that shirt, you'll die. You know, you need to fucking get serious. This is an earnest program. It's bollocks, it's not. You know, it is like Jessica said, we're a fucking wild, untamed, unruly bunch of fucking lunatics. You know? And when that energy, this isn't about being somebody's idea of normal somewhere or stable or anything else. It's better than that. I realised early on, this is a humane program, you know. It can afford people like me or you or anyone else. And it's not about trying to be, because we've all done that. I've tried to fit in with other people's worlds and it doesn't work for me, it cripples me. I have to be anaesthetized to kind of try and figure the universe out. I can't do it. This is about finding ourselves, it's about coming home, coming back home to ourselves and saying, it's that kind of like, you know, let them in, that knock, someone's knocking at the door. And I always do that and I have them all out there from Charles Manson to everyone else. And sometimes they're choking out and get them all in and bring all these bits in. But it's like that bringing the bits of ourselves has been my experience. And how am I doing?
10 minutes.
Okay. 10 minutes.
Okay.
Is that... Oh, sorry. So when I was in treatment, I did a step 4 and 5. Didn't know what I was doing, didn't understand words like powerlessness or unmanageability, but I had to go, you know. And to this day, I work in treatments and people say, I don't know really whether he's grasped fully the nuances of unmanageability. And I find myself going, yes, should we give him extra, you know, and I think, hang on. I said, I just remember how I was. What worked for me was that fellowship was about sitting down with people with a common purpose, you know, the therapeutic value, one addict helped another. Somehow, that healed me. Do you know what I mean? And it was about acceptance. It was about feeling I was okay and not alone. I didn't have to pretend anymore or hide away. When I went to treatment, I rang up from Victoria Station. My wife had had to extricate me from a second-hand shop in Blackstock Road in Islington in Finsbury Park, where I was buying knitted ties. I discovered a motherload of knitted ties. And I was like, she said, you're supposed to be at the station? I mean, I just thought I'd have to have something proper to wear when I got to this treatment centre. It's supposed to be very upmarket. She went, look, fucking get out, go, you know. Got me to the station and said, whatever happens, don't come back. If the train's struck by lightning, walk, you know, do, but don't turn up back at this house, right? She'd been in the fellowship 3 months, and at first she was doing all that stuff I was using, and by this time I was reduced to some kind of Peter Pan, you know, creature that lived upstairs, you know, with sort of on amphetamines and codeine lynxes, you know, some kind of like, I think I've said this loads of time, but my mate Kevin, who's dead now, I remember actually being in the bathroom with him. I think I was naked, like totally naked, which is how I spent a lot of my time by that, or with some horrible loincloth on or something. He was practically naked with some strange massive pulleys and sort of apparatus to get a line, some strange tourniquet scaffolding on his back, trying to get a hit in some odd place. And he was working off his body, you know, in some kind of ethereal body further out, like doing this sort of dousing thing with a 5 mil. He started laughing hysterically, but in a kind of insectoid praying mantis. He was like this. I was crouched down, you know, like this with a shaving mirror going, ooh, you know, having a hit somewhere. I said, what are you laughing at? He said, if grown-ups came in now, what would they think? He'd think this is what we do. Ha! How wrong! No. We only do it 24/7, you know, for 20 years. But it was just the concept of grown-ups, you know, at the time I was sort of 37, he was 45. But it gives away that child which is actually there, you know. When I got to treatment, I'd had all this stuff, got to the station, my wife said, don't come back. I rang the treatment centre, they said, we can't book you in today because the doctor's gone on leave, so you'll have to come back tomorrow. I said, I can't, I've got to come today. That was all I knew. And they said, well, where will you stay? I said, oh, I'll find a bed and breakfast somewhere. Now, the reality is I had 30 shillings on me. I had my train ticket and that. So I ended up wandering down the forest of Wiltshire, you know, in pissing rain with some my last two cans of special brew, some washed out, half washed out bag of amphetamine, and you know, some kind of methadone, but in an almost homeopathic dose left in a bottle that probably rain, you know, things like that. And kind of went in the next morning, like the Green Man tumbling into the village, you know, covered in hay and sort of leaves and that, but with an odd sort of old-fashioned suit underneath it. You know. But what this has given me is it's taken away a lot of that shame. If I had to go back there tomorrow and they said, where will you stay? I'd say, I don't know, can you help me out? I wouldn't have any shame in having 30 bob, do you know what I mean? And that shame I've all my life, when I was a kid sitting at the table, you know, it'd be like me and Simon are going to go and play football, and my dad go, you mean Simon and I? Fucking hell, we'd all be like that. It was like we were watched permanently by some arbiters of taste, you know, this sort of working class family huddled over sort of fish fingers somewhere, and people going, my God, did you hear that grammatically incorrect syntax they used there? Fucking hell. This clearly confirms what we thought about them. It's that realisation in recovery, nobody's watching. You know, nobody's watching. When I went along to a dance on the King's Road, when I was in Thurston House in Cheetah, and all I had was a pair of cowboy boots that someone had given me when I was using, so I put them on because they were kind of like the Vogue again, cowboy. They weren't, of course, the ones that were the Vogue were not the same as the ones I had. And I was walking on the King's Road with some kind of horrible half-mast pants on and these boots that were kind of this size. And I said to this sort of dead cool guy who was in the house at the time, I said, how do these boots look, man? And he said, they'd be all right in the Klondike, but they don't quite cut it on the King's Road. But I sort of still went and had that self-obsession, but it was great because I was standing there with these huge sort of hobbledehoy boots on at the edge of the dance floor, and someone said, if you dance, it feels better. Just get in there, and then you'll loosen up and it'll be okay. I got in there, and it was worse. It just got stiffer, and I was kind of like more exposed than that. But when I came back, I said, oh, did you see that? He said, no, I was too busy thinking about myself. And it was that realisation that we're all so self-obsessed. Anyway, no one's interested that much in me. But I'll finish on this real quick. And I hope there's something in there. You know, the thing is, I've had a few sponsors, and I've kind of had one guy where we became friends, and he didn't, this is 17 years ago, he didn't really, you know, his sponsor didn't really do the stuff, and we did the best we could, but that's what worked. I was in the right place at the right time. For me, that was the best I could do at the time. I've had sponsors since, my present guy, I've gone back through the steps, and it's been the best thing that ever happened, and it's deepened, this whole programme has deepened. There's a thing about you'll probably notice, they used to have these guys who used to go around reciting Homer in ancient Greece, and they were called the Homeric catatonics or something like that, and even reciting the poetry of Homer, they'd fall into a catatonic state, so they'd do like half a line, then they'd be struck by the beauty of the word, and they'd be, because there's a level of this where it's visceral. I feel the same way about this. I've had that same visceral, powerful showing up experience in these rooms. It's now, do you know what I mean? It's now. It's not about opinions or dissertations, and I'll do all that as well, do you know what I mean? But it's not about that. This gives us permission to arrive and put aside that burden of baggage and crap that we've carried around for so long. And to get there, I think of my mother. I ended up my mother going back to Liverpool. She came down to visit us, and I was, what about this? And my father hit me and all this. And she said, I'm going back to Liverpool. And she was really upset and all that. And I was at the station, I thought, what the fuck's wrong with me? I'm a bully, I'm in recovery, I'm 8 years clean. And my mother's an old woman. I could see this little woman going away, who'd done the best she could, you know. But the reality is, that inappropriate behaviour, after that, we've got a very good relationship today. So I've learned to have compassion for myself. You know, there's no, words like inappropriate are a load of bollocks. We can't do this. From when I was in treatment at Thurston House, they made me group leader because I was so deferential and so fucking, you know, go up to someone and go, look, I just wanted to say this. Please don't take offence, you know, all that kind of stuff. So immediately people take offence. You know, you immediately go, what? You know. And we had a guy there, he was like some kind of, he'd been some top hairdresser with Nicky Clark or someone. And he was from that kind of Chelsea set. So I was like some grovelling, shell-suited sort of being from Liverpool, you know. And he was like, he couldn't even see. He was like, that is somebody speak, my God, you know. And I was like, please. He made me group leader, and this guy used to leave his fucking mug all around the house, you know, so he'd end up washing it, and it really brought up stuff for me around my dad, you know, I remember saying to my dad, couldn't you wash the dishes sometimes? He said, I'm not a skivvy, and it was just me and him in the house, like, so what are you saying about me? And just the injustice of it, so I was seething with this injustice, you know, like some kind of rodentine sort of creature following this guy around with his bouffant and his Chelsea-ness and all his things, you know. Eventually, he left his mug, and I went up to him and I said, joke, can I have a word? And immediately he was on the bounce. He was one of those guys. He was dead big and tough. And he went, what? What? I'm watching the football or something. And I said, It's about your mug. And he went, who are you calling a fucking mug? You know, straight away, like, you know, I mean, your mug. So then, suddenly, I flipped, and I was going, you mug, you fuck. You know, and he was like, fucking pon my soul, you know. But what I'm saying is that the whole thing about it was that there's no way I could have done that in an appropriate, fluent way. I had to do that a bit, I had to do it inappropriately and kind of clumsily first, because that's how we learn to do things, by making mistakes. And that's what this has given me permission to do, is that we are all right. We can make mistakes, you know, sartorially, materially, in every which way. It's fucking, oh, we are okay. And that's the message, you know, I try to extend to what I've been. It's the message I occasionally hear, I give myself. And that's the most important thing. I pray every day. I do a resentment list to this day. I try to remember the newcomer and go up and speak. And whenever I do service, I immediately, all my crap goes, disappears. So there's a pragmatic reason for doing it as well. If I go and talk to someone else and I'm not trying to bag off with them, I'm trying to save them, you know what I mean? Or I'm not there for some vicarious, odd purpose. And what I've learned to do is look at my intention. Is my intention to heal or is it to hurt? Sometimes it's to hurt and it'll come out in a passive-aggressive, little snipey, sly way. And I need to address that because I don't need to do that anymore. And I've learned that I can speak to people directly and I can say, this is really the last thing I'll say, right? 30 seconds. There was a point where I'd left my wife, I'd gone off with someone in the fellowship, I'd years away, and of course, as it could have been foretold, I was just as uncomfortable there as I had been before. You know, and suddenly all the stuff I'd blamed on my wife who'd stopped me being, you know, president or something, suddenly became transparently obvious that it was not so, it was something to do with me, you know, which was very painful for me, you know. And I tried to blame the new person, but that didn't quite hold water. Right? But what was great about it, I ended up in a situation in a kind of men's group, and a guy said to me, if you can't show up where you live, how are you going to show up anywhere else? If you can't show up here, how is it going to be different anywhere else? You know? And it really, you know, all that, cut through all that stuff. And it's about commitment. I've lived as a spectator up in the gallery all my life. I've lived vicariously. I've not taken part because of that crippling pride, fear of failure and all that stuff. And it is about the courage to be foolish. You know, I've done theatre in recovery. I've done all kinds of things. I've done stand-up comedy. I've done fucking poetry, reading poetry out and that. I mean, poetry is not that good, is the truth of it. It's one of those things, when you listen to it, you think, by Jove, that's good. What did he say? I can't remember. It's about getting a perspective. As before, I thought, I'm a genius, nobody knows. You know, before I actually, but I could never actually go and perform. Going out there has given me some perspective, you know, and I'm kind of up for life now. But and that's brought me this. Anyway, I've gone on for ages. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.